Welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the trouble with pipelines, and Richard, our listeners may remember, there's long-standing debate over the Dakota Access Pipeline in the Upper Midwest, which occasioned all kinds of opposition at the start. This was most visible in the press through the opposition of the Standing Rock Sioux Indian tribe in North Dakota. And last week, a federal judge in D.C. said that that pipeline needed to be shut down and emptied. So before we even get into the analysis here, why don't we just start off with an explanation of the facts? How did this pipeline, A, get up and running despite the opposition, which is, I think, the last time anybody paid attention to this story? And B, how is it that it is now being turned back off?
Well, this is a saga which has taken at least 5 years, and I'm sure there are many stages I do not know. The first thing to understand about this is that pipelines present the unique challenges to any system of government regulation, whether it deals with environment or anything else. A pipeline is what I've come to call long and skinny as a property class. It runs through multiple jurisdictions, and just as any given person can wreck a pipeline by severing it at any one point, if any single jurisdiction decides that it's not going to give the permits for this thing to go through, then the pipeline is rendered useless because you can't get it from one end to the other. And this pipeline goes through 4 states, and it also goes through a number of other places, including lines that are owned by the federal government. And what you had to do is to go to the public utility commissions in each of these states and have a hearing. The strategy of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is essentially one from the beginning of strong intransigence. Their position about this is they've been taken to the coals multiple times by white Americans, that they resent deeply all of the incursions, all of the treaty breaches of one kind or another, and they're determined that they want to make sure that they have a very powerful say on the operation of this pipeline. Grievances like that essentially spurred them to make it extremely difficult for anybody to do one of these things. Don't show up meetings, be late, don't submit things into times, and so forth. If you read the first opinion of Judge Boasberg written back in 2016, where he basically sided with the pipeline company, the Dakota Access or Energy Transfers Partners, which is what the company's called, he details this in great detail. There is a stretch of this particular pipeline, which is under 1,100 feet, which runs through a government area, and you need to get special approval for this because it's now going to be interfered with minerals or something of the sort. And it's at this stress that the real energy took place. So you've got a pipeline of close to 1,100 miles long, and now you've got 1,100 feet, and if you can stop the pipeline there, everything essentially will fall out. So early on, the attacks were made largely on the basis of historical preservation, and there is the National Historic Preservation Act of 1965 or 6, and what it says is you have to consult with the tribes in order to make sure that whatever artifacts they have, whatever sacred sites they have, are going to be taken into account when you do the mix. It's not a statute which gives them a veto power, but if you don't take this stuff into account, they can get an injunction on the grounds that disclosure and cooperation is required. Required by the federal government. And those arguments, for the most part, tended to lose. And the Judge Boasberg said, I can't stop. And so the next round was to switch from the issues having to do with historic preservation to the issues having to do with environmental protection. And this is, again, an immensely complicated issue because the statute which governs this case, which governs the Keystone Pipeline, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, all the pipelines that are in trouble, is essentially also, quote-unquote, a disclosure statute, which says that you have to look before you leap, and unless you have a comprehensive understanding of what the pipeline's pros and negatives are going to be, you can't get the pipeline to be authorized through the system. It turns out that if the government wants to shut these pipelines down, generally speaking, rational basis or a very low standard of review will sustain them. So I've never seen a case in which a pipeline company has been able to overturn an adverse decision made by the Army Corps of Engineers. But it turns out it's the opposite way. way here if the Corps gives its approval. And in this case, it came after what they call an environmental assessment, which was 900 pages. I read actually most of it at one point in time, going through all of the problems, starting with siting, subsistence, leakage, and the like. And the Army Corps approved of this. And then the battle started to begin in court. And from the beginning, Boasberg was skeptical about what was going on, not on the obvious grounds having to do with safety of the pipeline. This thing is engineered to the nth degree. But there are a number of other things that you have to worry about. The three that he basically focused in on were the first question as to whether or not the pipeline gives rise to significant controversy. And to the extent that mere opposition to a pipeline going to a huge, loud shouting phase is opposition, you could shut things down. So clearly it doesn't mean that. And then he says what you have to do is to have some kind of scientific reason behind it. And then he started to talk about things like fishing rights and something known as environmental justice. And the last means you cannot have a pipeline which has disproportionate impact on a tribe. The environmental justice issue, I think, is a complete red herring in a case of this sort, because a pipeline has to go 1,100 miles. It's not going to be sited like a dump next to some poor neighborhood, which is going to have to bear all the pollution. You can't make a pipeline of anything other than uniform quality. And nonetheless, there are always issues of that sort, and he was not quite happy about that. And then the question about fishing rights, you have the following serious question. The water is some distance from the pipeline, which doesn't cross into the Indian reservation. So the case essentially turned on the following claim by the plaintiff, which is that you could imagine a hole in a pipe, which is exactly a kind of a needle wide, and it would reduce the pressure in the pipe, this hole, by 1%, which means that you could leak indefinitely under their view, 6,000 gallons a day, and then they would have this huge buildup underground, and it would eventually reach the tribal lands. The average amount of pipeline losses in any given year is you know, maybe 500,000 barrels, a number that's going down in these things. And there's never been, in the history of the world, a pipeline where the hole doesn't get larger. And this pipeline, by the way, in terms of its monitoring, is better than every other pipeline that's built, because all the pipelines are under consistent technical upgrades with every passing year. So if you take average losses over the last 30 years, it's going to overstate the risk for a new pipeline, which is state of the art. If you looked at the cutaway, you'd see this pipeline is bigger, it's steeper set, it has more instrumentation on it than any of the pipelines that are located even closer to the waters that are claimed to be damaged by the tribe. And what happened is Boasberg, with an obvious sense of unhappiness, said, you know, I really want to see a great deal of study done more on this controversy point with this potential 600 or 6,000 barrel leak per day that he was talking about. And he says, the only way I'll get cooperation out of the Army Corps of Engineer is to shut the pipeline down for 13 months so they can do this. And one of the things that makes this so tragic is you then ask the question, exactly what are you going to look for? And why is it going to take 13 months to write 10,000 pages on this particular thing when it's perfectly clear that this pipeline has been in operation for 3 years, has not posed a remote threat of this? But the way in which Boasberg looked at it is hypothetical objections are perfectly legitimate, notwithstanding that the actual performance has gone in the other way. And emptying a pipeline is no easy thing to do, and maintaining a very large pipeline when it's empty is actually very, very difficult to do. If a pipeline is empty, pressures from external sources could cause damage, which won't happen when it's full. Think of it in this way, Troy. If you have a house, you want to insure this house if it's unoccupied or occupied. And the premiums are always lower for occupied pipe houses. And the same thing is true with respect to occupied pipelines. They're safer. So you're creating additional damage. And then if you have to reroute this pipeline somewhere else, that's going to be further complication. This is clearly an effort to kill the pipeline. And it carries 570,000 barrels a day from the Bakken fields and the Three Fork fields in North Dakota down to Illinois. This is a huge transformation of what's going on. I hope there'll be a stay and a review by the appellate court, which is a rather different court in the District of Columbia Circuit Court than it was 2 years ago. But this indicates the real kind of deep resentment towards pipelines for grounds that I regard as frankly incomprehensible.
Well, let me have you advance that line of thinking. So those are the implications of shutting one of these down. Can you walk us through what the practical implications of holding up pipelines looks like? Not just in this case, but there is opposition to almost every one of these projects, where even if they end up successfully opening up, it's usually only after a protracted legal fight. And like in this case, you had the judge here, for instance, say, well, oil demand is way down because of COVID. This isn't going to matter all that much. Can these projects really be held up without much consequence for the broader public?
No, they can't. And one of the things that's so extraordinary is you're talking about a decision which, in terms of its impact on society at large, on producers, on pipeline shippers, on potential customers, on shipments by truck and by rail and all the rest, and renegotiation are complicated. You're talking about probably several millions upon millions of dollars of inconvenience. He writes a sloppy 24-page opinion requiring that all of this stuff be done. I mean, it's amazing how little attention he gives to it. He's saying on the basis of two paragraphs of writing, all of which is wrong as far as I can tell, that we now have to have 13 months of study. And by the way, when we're done with that 13 months of study, you know that the objections are going to continue to come. And even if the pipeline prevails on this, they have these two other grounds about environmental justice and about damage to water and fishing grounds. None of this, it just becomes a perpetual movement. And he says, well, it's COVID, it's down. Now, look, this is the problem. You're going to shut it down for 13 months. It's down now, but demand fluctuates. So is he going to open it up if it turns out that production now quadruples in the months that follow when it turns out the economy comes back to a larger force? No. It is just a make weight. I mean, I thought Boasberg was a pretty decent judge when he wrote the first opinion, and I thought he was rather measured. The tone in this one is markedly different. Instead of having exasperation at the tribes for their nonstop obstructionism, including violence at the site, by the way, what he does is he has exasperation and resentments towards the Army Corps of Engineers. I read the report that they wrote, the so-called environmental aspect, and you know, it was a very professional report. There was nothing about it that would give rise to the slightest opposition. One of the things about the Corps, it's kind of funny, is when they decide that they want to block a particular project, sometimes they go on grounds that seem to be rather preposterous. But in this case, every single point that was raised has already been covered in this report. And now he's saying, I just want more. If you look at the study and you ask yourself, well, what other information would you like to have? Here are four questions that I want you to answer. He doesn't do that, because there aren't any questions of that sort that he wants to answer. So what's happened is the entire disclosure game has killed it. Now, there was also the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. That was in the Supreme Court over a ridiculous issue in which it turned out that the opponents, the so-called cow pasture people, had said, well, this pipeline passes under many trails. And what we need to do for a pipeline that's 500 or 600 feet underground is to make sure that the environmental study is done by the people who own the trail 600 feet above it. And there are 20 of these trails, so you need 20 different studies, each of which comprehends essentially, you know, 500 or 1,000 feet. And the Supreme Court rejected that particular argument, but it won in the Fourth Circuit. So up you go. In the meantime, the rest of the Fourth Circuit report said this environmental impact study that we did is deficient for the following end reason, and you're going to have to remand. So after winning the Supreme Court case, they had to face the remand on all of the substantive issues. They kind of figured out that it was going to go exactly the same way as the DAPL pipeline eventually went, and they basically pulled the plug on the project, wasting millions of dollars. Southern Florida is a growth area. Energy certainly needs to be there. Pipelines are by far the safest way to get there. Boasberg doesn't seem to believe that. He seems to think it's okay to do it by truck and by trail, that the evidence is inconclusive. That's just wrong as far as I can tell. A pipeline is a controlled environment. You put a truck and it's on a road or on a train. By heavens, there are all sorts of external circumstances. And if those things blow, they'll explode, whereas a pipeline will start to leak. And these things are designed so that you could shut down a pipeline almost instantaneously, even if somebody just severs the whole thing from top to bottom. There are all sorts of ways in these pipelines, which are about 42 inches in diameter, I think, to just close them off. It just to my mind, it is simply a disguised effort to use NEPA, not because anybody cares about the disclosures. Everybody knows what's at stake. It's just an argument that we can basically bamboozle these things and essentially lead to the end of the use of fossil fuels. That's exactly what's involved here. That's what Friends of the Earth are about all their time. And so you give these technical objections based upon non-disclosures of trivial issues when the larger agenda has nothing to do with disclosures. It has everything to do with the dangerous move, as far as I can see, to try to make wind and solar the primary sources of energy without any knowledge whatsoever of the enormous limitations associated with both of those forms of energy.
That leads me to exactly where I was going to go next. But first, we should probably just identify for our audience, you referenced NEPA there, just explain in two sentences what NEPA is.
It's the 1970 statute called the National Environmental Protection Act. And what it does, or Policy Act, excuse me, it's not protection. It indicates that you have to have certain amounts of hearing before you're allowed to make a substantive decision. And very early on, what happened is the question arose as to whether or not when you had to go before an administrative agency, could anybody who was disappointed with the outcome of the agency challenge it in court? And in a case called Calvert Cliffs, which was one of the early successful attacks on the creation of new nuclear power plants, which essentially was stopped by lawsuits like this in the 1970s, so that there's been no new nuclear power plant in the United States since 1977. All the plants are too old at this particular point. What Skelly Wright said is, I want to bring on a flood of lawsuits to stop this stuff. And he did, by allowing any single person who's aggrieved to bring a lawsuit to stop it. So what happens is, before an administrative agency, it's the median vote who tends to prevail. The moment you go into court and you get Skelly Wright cheering you on, it's the most extreme opponents that dictate the policy. And that shift, by allowing the private right of action, had redefined NEPA from a statute which most people would be quite comfortable support to one which, at least in my case, seems to be a total and complete disaster because of the peculiar asymmetry in the stakes. And if you start looking at these reports, I mean, it's always clear, what do you think of administrative studies? And it's like everything else, Troy, they vary all over the lot. But I've looked at a number of these studies that have been done to prepare for a nuclear power plants. There was a case called Baltimore Gas, which upheld one of them. And in this particular case, and these are first-class studies. They're commissioned by private parties, done by professional planners. They understand what the various oppositions are, and they raise it. And so one of the ways you can tell this is that the Obama administration, by the way, was out to get the DAPL pipeline the moment that Boasberg did something, and twice, once in September and once in December, they basically try to throw sand in the gears. In September, after the pipeline won, what happened is the Obama administration, within 1 hour, had the Army Secretary, Assistant Secretary, a woman named Joanne Darcy, and had the Justice Department and the Transportation Department, I think it was, all saying, we want you voluntarily to stop building, even though the decision was sound. And then when the Army Corps approved this back in December of 2016, Ms. Darcy again says, we've looked at all of this. We want a full environmental statement because we think the construction of this pipeline is disrespectful for the Sioux tribe, and we want you to consider some alternative route, which is longer, more expensive, and more environmentally damaging, all of which had been considered before. And so it was essentially, she wrote a 1 or 2 page memo saying, we want to have this. Trump comes into office. His environmental office basically removes her particular command. The report stands, it goes to Congress, and then under applicable statutory provisions, it's approved. So basically, in the end of January 2017, it got to go. There are more objections. They build the pipeline. In March of 2020, Boasberg says, I think we really need a full statement. I have a choice as to whether to shut the pipeline down or to let it continue. And then in July, he says, I'm shutting it down. And what I thought was a simply dreadful opinion.
Let me have us end on the note that I diverted you from earlier. There is this common refrain, Richard, from progressives on these issues, where they will say, look, this dirty, expensive, infrastructure-intensive focus on fossil fuels is so yesterday. We know that renewables are the future. We can get by on wind and solar. We can get by with electric cars, and the environment's going to be cleaner, and we're even going to create jobs in the process. How do you react to that?
Well, first of all, you create jobs in process. The question is not whether you create jobs. The question is whether you create jobs that generate more value than not. There are more people, I think, in the solar and wind business than there are today in the fossil fuel business. But those two things together produce 2 or 3 or 4% of the total amount of energy. The most important renewable is probably going to be something like hydropower, which by definition can be only used in limited locations. There's no future with respect to this. The operation on a given day may be clean, but this stuff is actually deadly. You have to build these things. You have to catch signs. Basically, in order to synthesize these very, very heavy wind mills that you're doing, you got to do a lot of concrete, a lot of specialized steel. They're very intensive. You then have to set them out in the ocean, and you have to have a long transmission belt. When they decommission, it turns out you've got to rip them up and take them somewhere else. If they start killing large birds, which they do all the time, you have to give them exemptions from the Endangered Species Act. Then you give them huge cash subsidies. The whole thing is a farce. Solar energy, you have to cover acres upon acres of land. And the current rules for anybody else under the DNR run as follows. This is a true story. One of my friends owns a farm in Wisconsin, and he says, I wanted to put a 3-foot runway over a 4-foot thing. So my entire little runway path was going to be about 20 square feet or 30 square feet. And he needed to get an apartment from the DNR on the grounds that blocking the light with the 20-foot thing is a form of thermal pollution, which requires a government permit. Now, when you want to put up solar fields that can take acre upon acre upon acre, where they can high concentrations of damages using toxic chemicals, all of this stuff is just fine. Where, again, the assembly and disassembly and the operation of these things is highly dangerous. And so it's only if you look at the injury, not at anything else that's there. Then, of course, this stuff is always erratic. So you go to Germany, and what they do is they take dirty coal, which you have to then put into service when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow. And the German costs, in fact, are higher by a factor of 3 or 4-fold than anywhere else. This is a case of German delusion. And they emit huge amounts of pollution with bituminous coal. And they won't use anthracite coal because it's higher in carbon dioxide but lower in everything else. And this sort of plays into the global warming thing, that carbon dioxide is our major problem as opposed to stuff which gets into the lungs and kills you rather in the short run. The energy, the economy of that system is all built out of pickup sticks of one kind or another, heavily subsidized, completely inefficient. And the jobs argument is irrelevant. If you start looking at fossil fuels and fracking, what you do is you want to make sure that they're very strong rules in place so that if they do leak and they do cause damage, these guys have to have insurance and they have to pay liability. And you want to have these things periodically inspected. And you could easily find mistakes. But again, the technology improvements in these areas has been at least as rapid as it has been in solar. And the economics is greater. One of the ways in which we can see the dynamics in the economy is you look at the percentage of coal used in the economy 2010 to 2020, and coal goes down. And why does it go down? Because even if you don't regulate it, the cost per unit of energy on the old plant is higher than it is with natural gas. And so the stuff simply does not make it into the supply stream. And virtually everybody who predicted how these energy sources would look 10 years ago was completely wrong. The technology has completely overtaken what had gone on. And what we do is we have a fracking system, which is extremely powerful, for the most part, pretty clean. And all of the inputs are much cheaper now than they were when this thing started. So if you don't want to make a question saying, well, we've improved solar energy, you have to say, have you improved it more rapidly than you have the other? Maybe in certain places in Tucson, Arizona, you can use that. But as a general source, you'd be lucky if you could get solar energy with everything that you want to do up to 5 or 10%, at which particular point you then have the Michael Moore story, his wonderful movie, right? A little bit crazy. But it says, sure, you could basically hook up to a Tesla thing and you use electric energy. Well, how do they get the electric energy? Well, they got a coal generator or an oil generator or a natural gas generator that's creating the electrical energy. So just move it one step back. So all of these things are, I think, just downright delusional in terms of the way in which this works. As your former colleague at the Manhattan Institute, Mark Mills, has written piece after piece after piece, which goes through the physics of this stuff. And the limits you're talking about are limits of nature. They're not limits of politics. And all of this tends to be ignored. It's a very sad commentary. The pipeline thing, by the way, just as a final note, is now becoming linked very much to the climate control, carbon dioxide change issue. So that one of the opinions by my good friend, Tom Griffiths, you know, he writes an opinion in which he says you have to slow down the Atlantic Coast Pipeline because you haven't taken into account how much emissions from a pipeline is going to influence global temperature. But there aren't emissions from pipelines. They're from factories. The number is trivial. It's the downstream uses that you want to regulate. You don't want to regulate them through the pipeline. But that was a case in which it turned out the pipeline lost. That was a case in which Judge Boasberg relied when he issued his particular decision. The world has gone on this particular point off of the deep end as far as I can tell. And that there is no excuse for these kinds of decisions. What we have to do is to start bringing ourselves back into cases where we realize that if a pollution starts to take place, we punish it and we fine it. And we stop it, but we don't stop things when the probability of something like that is so low that the greater danger comes from the use of alternative energy supplies that are both dirtier and more dangerous than the stuff that the pipeline promises.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at Hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.